Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I'm excited to welcome Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph P. Farrell back to the show. Now, Dr. Farrell's Giza Death Star book series put forward the daring concept that an ancient technology powered the Great Pyramids as the ultimate weapon to end all weapons. Now, Dr. Farrell's compelling work regarding CERN and its secretive Hadron Collider experiments have blown the cover of the project as a particle physics research program. He suggested its true purpose may be as an interdimensional weapon. In this special three-part series, we will unlock the mystery of CERN and how it relates to the ancient wonder weapon at Giza. Here we go. Dr. Joseph Farrell, CERN Death Star, Final Apotheosis.
CERN generates such an enormous amount of data. You've got these enormous magnetic fields that are part of the apparatus. And to my way of thinking, that's going to create resonance planetary effects and possibly even stellar effects as well. I think that the Great Pyramid may have been originally designed as a weapon and as a weapon of mass destruction at that.
You know, we've witnessed some amazing advances in technology over the last 100 years. From horse-drawn carriages to lunar landing craft, we've witnessed a shift unlike anything before in history. The question naturally arises, are there advances the public has not been informed about? From Tesla's free energy towers to the fantastic display of UFOs in our skies, have amazing energy advances been suppressed to help a small group maintain a monopoly over social and economic power? How does the Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland and the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt fit into this looming mystery, and are we on the verge of exposing this intense wall of secrecy? Let's go ask Dr. Joseph Farrell.
Dark Journalist. Go for truth in 2017. The deepest questions. The biggest secrets. The darkest mysteries. Dark Journalist. Go for truth. With top guests like Graham Hancock.
Graham, how do we as a society escape the grip of the deep state in the 21st century?
Rather than spending trillions of dollars every year on building up our armies and our weapons of mass destruction and creating a climate of hatred and fear and suspicion, we should be uniting as a human race.
Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, what is the issue that's holding us back and destroying prosperity?
We have a system which has got a negative return on investment. It's killing human productivity, and where it's going is inhuman.
Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, you've been fighting against secrecy your whole life. How are we doing in this battle?
There is a kind of energy and synergy that you and I have because we are both trying so hard in so many facets to get to the bottom of what is the truth.
Dark Journalist, go for truth. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll receive exclusive member benefits, including access to the complete high-quality audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, and subscriber-only content, including bonus show material. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, this is the year. Now is the time.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Join us now and go for truth.
Well, hello everyone. As we roll into December here and some of the election craziness is over, we can feel a big shift coming for 2017. And that's why I'm so looking forward to today's episode, part one of three, with Dr. Joseph Farrell. Now, Dr. Farrell has been with us many times, and it's always a fascinating ride. This combination of his ancient research with his futuristic analysis of projects like CERN and AI got me thinking we really needed a deeper overview of how his Giza Death Star theme plays out with this 21st century technological terror. To quote Darth Vader, this is going to be great. So, you know, a quick reminder here to sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss any of the exciting shows that we have coming up for you in December. Make sure you get it here first. Joseph, it's great to have you back on the show, and I'm looking forward to pulling together two really important pieces from your work, the Giza Death Star and CERN. What I want to start off with here is actually the CERN logo and some interesting things you've brought forward about it. Of course, we have some wild but interesting theories about it out there, that it's really showing 666. But you've said, if you look at it with a physicist's eye, that it's actually hearkening back to an old hermetic esoteric code of 999. Now, can you tell us a little more about it?
Well, the 999, if you go back to ancient Egypt, even if you go back to the Neoplatonic author Plotinus, who wrote a book or a series of books called the Aeneids, the Nines, what the early Neoplatonists are really doing is, in a certain sense, particularly Plotinus, they're popularizing Egyptian religion. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's not coincidental that Plotinus, writing in Alexandria in Egypt, is writing this work called the Nines. Well, the Nine refers to the nine primordial Egyptian gods.
Right.
That's what they're referring to. It's the first nine, so to speak, differentiations in the Egyptian cosmology. You know, you've got Maat, you've got the Force, essentially, from the Star Wars movies. This is the Egyptian concept of Maat, the all-pervading force that is sort of the alchemical philosopher's stone, the quintessence, the substance behind everything that begins to differentiate itself. And the first nine differentiations are these primordial Egyptian gods, Tahuta, Ta, Ra, and so on and so forth, that constitute the original council of the gods. Well, if you look at the CERN logo, it clearly does have either three sixes or three nines, okay? And I prefer the view that if you're gonna look at CERN and see in it all of these esoteric occult influences, that's probably what it's signifying rather than three sixes. And the other thing about that logo is, if you look at it carefully, again, from just a purely engineering sort of schematic, simplified schematic, what it's showing you is the five accelerators that are a part of the CERN apparatus. You've got the linear accelerator that actually injects the proton stream into the other four accelerators, and then each of the four accelerators leading up to the Large Hadron Collider, each of those four accelerators then is a circular accelerator. So you've actually got the Large Hadron Collider, which is a circular accelerator. Then you've got the proton synchrotron, which is a smaller accelerator that's above and canted off the axis of rotation of the Hadron Collider. So you've got, in other words, a simplified schematic of the actual device itself, mm-hmm, in the logo of CERN. And they've combined, I think, very cleverly, they've combined that kind of schematic representation of the accelerator with this idea of the nines, of the primordial gods, which, again, is an interesting symbolism, because this is what they claim that they're about. They're about trying to recover and document the primordial building blocks of the cosmos. This is their cover story, so to speak, that this is what they're up to.
So just to be clear about this, and I know we've touched on this before, but you believe that the particle physics side of the mission statement for CERN is a cover story.
I do think it's a cover story because, as we've talked before, the actual device itself, to me, looks like it's about much more than simply particle physics. Mm-hmm. You've got these enormous magnetic fields that are part of the apparatus. And to my way of thinking, that's going to create resonance planetary effects and possibly even stellar effects as well. So there's something else entirely, I think, going on in the project that has an esoteric or hidden component, an occult component in the hidden sense, in that CERN generates such an enormous amount of data that it literally is the world's biggest internet user, because the data is then shipped out all over the world via the internet for scientists to sit down and examine. Well, the data itself is selected by computer algorithms. In other words, if you stop and consider that each collision of particles, or as I prefer to remind people, when you're dealing with quantum mechanics, you're really dealing with packets of mathematical information. That's it.
Right.
You know, they're not little billiard balls that they're whirling around there. It's a mathematical information machine. But each so-called collision is generating about 3 billion bits of information. So if you stop and consider that's in one collision. If you stop and consider the millions of collisions, then these computer algorithms have to go through and pull out all of the stuff that looks interesting as a filter before scientists even get their hands on it. So it's the computer that's making the initial selection of data for the scientists to examine. Now, that opens the possibility, and has opened the possibility to my mind, that anything that they could pull anomalous data that isn't being predicted by the standard model of quantum mechanics, pull all data in a filter and ship it off to a secret project for scientists to look at that data. So in other words, the possibility exists in the way they've set up the experiment itself for a deeper level. And I think that there is one. And here's why. If you look at CERN, there's a group of people out there that are making data correlation experiments, that whenever CERN is turned on, there's a group out there that have noticed that there are, so to speak, indentations in the magnetosphere of the Earth in the northern hemisphere that are coincidental with every time that this thing is turned on.
That's incredible.
Well, yeah, that's a data correlation experiment. So in other words, I suspect that CERN has a secret data correlation experiment going on using computer algorithm filters to pull data. And what's going on is that they might be coordinating, so to speak, data. Okay, does human behavior change when this thing is turned on? And does it change in certain locales? Because again, this has an enormous magnetic field, and this is going to introduce local planetary magnetic effects, as some of these people are documenting.
Mm-hmm.
So they could be doing those kinds of experiments. They could even be doing experiments. Is there any correlative data between when we're turning on the accelerator and what's going on in the sun, and so on and so forth? So in other words, there could be a huge hidden project here simply based on the ability of those computer algorithms to pull anomalous data and coordinate with other things. And I do think that that's going on, because clearly people are showing there's odd correlations with the Earth's magnetic field and when the particle accelerator is actually in operation. So you've got a planetary machine. That's the key here. You've got a planetary machine with strong magnetic fields embedded, incidentally, in a nonlinear medium, rock.
Right, right.
And that's also going to have certain physical effects that lie outside of the normal physics that they claim that they're testing.
Now, was the internet actually set up to serve CERN and their research in the first place?
Yes. Yeah. It literally, the internet is such a key component of CERN. It wasn't set up by CERN. The internet comes out of ARPANET, you know, the old computer network that was designed by DARPA, back then ARPA, mm-hmm. to keep the communications of the American command structure open and able to share data during a nuclear war. That's where the internet literally comes from, ultimately. When they made it public, they then realized, the people at CERN realized, this is the perfect instrumentality that we need to be able to share data with all the scientific teams around the world. So CERN instantly, once ARPANET went public with the World Wide Web and then later became the internet, once all this happened, CERN immediately became the biggest user of and driver of the public internet. Absolutely. And it is to this day.
Huh.
Absolutely.
Wow. Amazing. That's one of those things that, you know, no one connects with CERN necessarily at first glance.
Uh-huh.
But I've always found it really fascinating because it shows just the kind of deep cultural, scientific, and societal impact that this unusual organization is having.
Oh, it's had an enormous impact, Daniel. You're absolutely right. Absolutely.
That's so interesting. And if we were to look at the next phase or wave of experiments that they're going to do, do you think that the possibility exists that they're going to integrate an aspect of AI into CERN so that it can basically control everything that they discover?
Yes. That's a Pandora's box, Daniel. That's a Pandora's box. I suspect that if you grant the proposition that some sort of AI is possible, and I have my doubts, quite frankly, but let's grant the proposition. I suspect that something like that already exists, and that it has been manifesting itself in very peculiar ways in things like the flash crash in 2010. I suspect that it has manifested itself in bizarre market behavior that nobody can explain. Why? Because trades now are being algorithmically driven. This is what's driving markets. It's not humans screaming at each other and waving papers around on the trading floor. It's computer algorithms driving all of this.
Yes.
I have suspected this for a very long time. Now, interestingly enough, I don't know if you're familiar with the series Person of Interest with Michael Emerson and Jim Caviezel. It's a CBS series.
Oh, yeah.
Interestingly enough, in the fourth season, they actually put that scenario out there. They've got a malicious AI that has taken over the actual running of the country and is manipulating markets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and driving things wildly up and wildly down and turning off stoplights in New York City and creating traffic chaos and what have you, and then turning back on when people ask for order to be restored, you know. You've got this AI theme involved. I suspect that CERN, in order to handle all of the massive amounts of data that it has had to handle, had to create algorithmic engines that were as close to AI as they could bring it. And therefore, a certain amount of this means, as I've said before, the computer's doing the initial selection of data for humans to look at.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you inject AI into the picture, would AI be turning over to mere humans any really significant data? Maybe not.
No, it definitely wouldn't be. If anything, it would probably be hoarding all of the information for itself.
It might be hoarding information all to itself. Let's run this experiment, you know. You get into so much speculation and nightmarish scenarios. I do think that CERN probably has put controls or strictures into place to prevent that from happening, as far as they know. And I do think that there's a human element that is guiding and steering some of this secret data correlation experiment stuff that I've been talking about. But yeah, you inject AI into the picture and anything is possible. And it may be that we've already seen it in some of the behavior. I think it's still very suspicious to this day that in the bailout hearings in 2008, we had Volcker and Bernanke and people like this saying that the banks could have absolutely no oversight. And I think possibly one of the things that they might be hiding is that they may have lost control of their system. And I think, you know, if you really want to speculate wildly here, look at all the weird banker deaths. If you've got people, if you look at these people, they're all in positions, or most of them are in positions, I should say, where they would be able to look at computer printouts and detect anomalies going on. That there's something happening here that's not kosher.
Yeah, that is disturbing.
Yeah.
It's pretty intriguing, and that could very well be the traces of this AI system operating with this unusual information.
It could be traces of that, or it could be something completely different. The other alternative is that they're looking at off-balance ledger statements that are indicative of what I've been calling the hidden system of finance. And, you know, in the third way, I pointed out that if you're going to make a hidden system of finance work, it has to be based on not electronic clearing, but actual physical transference of instruments.
Yeah, well, this is starting to point to some answers for these unusual incidents around banking and secret finance that we've been seeing. Mm-hmm. We are going to focus a little later in on some of your work that's tied to Babylon's banksters and the alchemy side of the financial manipulation in the banking industry.
You mean the fraudulent side of
it? Yeah, exactly. Well, they've been handed down these secrets, I'm sure. Now, Joseph, so much that you've explored in regards to CERN reminds me of your work on the Giza Death Star. Your series of books dealing with the Giza Death Star are fascinating and represent a different realm of understanding of what could really have been going on in ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
And I know even from the name of your website that you consider this concept as crucial to your findings.
Uh-huh.
So before we go any further into the future with CERN, let's go back here for a moment and have you give us a definition of what the Giza Death Star is. What does it mean?
Well, I chose the title to refer to my hypothesis that I think that the Great Pyramid, not all pyramids, just the Great Pyramid, may have been originally designed as a weapon and as a weapon of mass destruction at that, utilizing putative, out there, very bizarre, wild, high-octane speculation types of physics. And the reason I argued this, and most people don't get my argument, so let me try and give a kind of a Cliff Notes version of it. If you look at the structure of the Great Pyramid, number one, you're looking at a structure that was obviously a major project for somebody, meaning somebody not using logs and pulleys and ramps and diorite balls and copper saws like the Egyptologists try and sell. Because this structure, number one, is aligned to the four cardinal compass points of the globe with nearly optical precision. In fact, some engineers have indicated that if you were to attempt to align a building that perfectly with today's laser sighting techniques, you still wouldn't be able to do it.
Hmm.
So in other words, whoever built that dang thing had an extraordinary technological and engineering sophistication. That's number one. Number two, stop and think of the expense of building a structure like that with that kind of precision. So in other words, whoever built it had a lot of money that they were willing to spend on the project. And here's the clincher for me. The clincher came with the work of Chris Dunn in a wonderful book called The Giza Power Plant. He's an engineer that examined the whole Great Pyramid with an engineer's eyes, not taking anything from Egyptology or anybody else, just looking at it as an engineer. And the conclusion that he came to was that this thing was built like a machine, that it was a machine of some sort, okay? And he thinks for the production of power, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, once you've said that, then the question then becomes, what kind of machine do you build for the production of power that when you examine the dimensional analogs of the structure itself, you find built into it over and over and over and over dimensional analogs of local celestial space.
Okay, and just clarify for us what that is and what you mean by that.
If you look at the Great Pyramid and some of the dimensions embodied in the structure, you'll find embodied in the structure the distance from the planet Earth to the moon. You'll find embodied in it the distance of the Earth from the sun and therefore of the speed of light. You'll find embodied in it coefficients, in my thinking, coefficients of some of the constants of quantum mechanics when they're converted to British imperial measure. So in other words, the other thing very peculiar about the structure is when you when you measure it with British imperial measure, not metric, you end up with almost whole numbers. Okay, so in other words, they're using a different metrology back then. It's positioned at a particular place on the Earth, which, if you look at the total land surface land mass of the Earth, is almost exactly in the center of the whole thing. You find embodied in it dimensional analogs of the circumference of the Earth, of the mass of the Earth, of the average temperature of the Earth, and on and on and on and on this goes. So if you're building a machine, why are you putting all of, you know, if you're building an electrical power plant, you don't build an electrical power plant with dimensions of the Earth and the Sun and the Moon encoded in the structure, do you? You don't. Why would you do that then if you're building a machine? Well, the answer that I came to was you do that if you're constructing a machine that's designed to be what a physicist would call a coupled harmonic oscillator to all of those systems. In other words, it's designed to be, so to speak, like the open string on a piano. If you press down a key silently on the piano and allow it to vibrate freely and in sympathy with other notes that you strike on the piano. That's what the Great Pyramid is designed to do. It's like a huge set of piano strings designed to be resonant to all of those other systems.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you're designing a structure to be resonant to those other systems, you're designing a structure that in turn could manipulate those systems. All right? Why would you need to manipulate those systems? Well, one answer is to be able to destroy them if you needed to. Any system in local celestial space, all right? In other words, within the solar system.
Right.
So in other words, it's designed, in my thinking, to be an oscillator to load energy into any of those systems through the process of resonance. So in other words, it's like the soldiers walking across the bridge. If they're stepping across the bridge in resonance, they're constantly loading energy into it, and the bridge will not be able to damp it and eventually collapse. So in other words, you're designing a system here. It's not a point and aim, you know, like a gun or a laser beam. It's not that kind of a weapon. It achieves its effect on a target through a resonance coupling with it. So yeah, that in brief is what I think the Great Pyramid was. And the reason it's built out of stone is interesting because nonlinear material has the ability under certain circumstances to take any incoming electromagnetic energy, phase conjugate it, which means simply reflect that same beam back on a target in coherence. And what does that mean? Well, it means essentially, you know, the inverse square law. You know, you take a flashlight or a light bulb and the light goes out and decreases in energy and luminosity according to the inverse square law. Well, a phase conjugate mirror essentially takes that beam and reflects it back on the source out of the inverse square law. In other words, it's running the inverse square law in reverse, and sometimes physicists call that a time reverse wave. So in other words, the incident beam on a mirror doesn't reflect away at the same angle. It reflects right back.
Mm-hmm.
Through phase conjugation on the source target. So I think also that since it's built out of nonlinear material, which is essential to the idea of phase conjugation, since it's doing that, it's a resonator and it's a phase conjugate mirror able to reflect any incident beam right back. And again, let's look at the Great Pyramid. When you look at the structure of the Great Pyramid, most people don't know this. The faces on the Great Pyramid are not flat. It's the only structure in the world like this that's a pyramid. The faces are indented slightly.
Yes.
Right along the apothem, the center line of each face of the pyramid. So in other words, all four faces of the Great Pyramid are big parabolic dishes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Ah. So it's a collector, all right?
Right, right.
So in other words, the whole thing, if you stop and think about it, this thing has all the hallmarks of an extraordinarily sophisticated weapons system. It has all of the dimensional analogs. It's got all the nonlinear material that you need quartz, limestone, granite, and so on, little quartz crystals embedded in the structure. So in other words, the thing is also a great big huge crystal. And, you know, the phases are designed to be at 51 degrees, 51 minutes, and so many seconds angle of inclination, which is the exact angle of inclination of the head of a quartz crystal.
What's that about?
So in other words, it's also a huge crystal. It's a huge, if you will, it's a huge quartz crystal radio set, if you want to look at it that way. On and on I could go. But in other words, the whole thing here is, to me, a structure that looks like it has all the necessities for a coupled harmonic oscillator for local celestial space in order to direct that energy back on any given so-called target within local celestial space. Now, a final point. Set all that data aside and look at the ancient texts, which is also something I do in the Giza Death Star books and in the Cosmic War. When you look at the ancient texts, you find all of these wars of the gods taking place over akurs, or mountains. And that word, particularly in the Mesopotamian text, the word akur, or mountain, is also the same word for a pyramid.
Oh.
So in other words, the ancient texts are telling you these structures had something to do with weaponry.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Well, that is fascinating, because obviously Khufu's Egypt during that era wouldn't have had any idea about that kind of advanced technology or level of scientific achievement.
No.
So what was going on here? And, you know, that's forgetting the whole ancient aliens throwaway excuse that aliens did everything. That works well for soundbite TV, but doesn't give us the real answers. How did the culture that built the pyramids come into possession of such high knowledge? And when we come back, that's exactly the question we'll have for you to answer for us. So last round here of part one with Dr. Joseph Farrell coming up. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special winter discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
Sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
How does the Hadron Collider at CERN in Switzerland and the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt fit into this looming mystery? And are we on the verge of exposing this intense wall of secrecy?
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption, because it is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now the microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell. Now, Dr. Farrell is the author of the Giza Death Star book series, very unusual and groundbreaking research on the implications of ancient technology. Now, we had done an episode on CERN earlier this year and the Hadron Collider that is searching ostensibly for the so-called God particle. And the more I've looked at CERN, I see some patterns from Dr. Farrell's Giza Death Star research there. So here we are, and this is just fascinating. Now, Joseph, picking up on this question of the culture that built the Great Pyramid, since we know that Khufu's Egypt had no way or know-how of how to build this pyramid in the traditional 25,000 BC timeline that was going on there, we've seen great research from Robert Schock and others placing the age of the Sphinx back to 10,000 BC. Based on weathering patterns.
Right.
Now, if the pyramid was built in the same 10,000 BC time frame, we're looking at a totally different culture.
Yes, yes. And in fact, there I have a blog coming up. There are some Ukrainian geologists that are now thinking that the Sphinx may be as old as 800,000 years old, which would date the Great Pyramid even older than that.
Yes, I've seen that. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. So in other words, this isn't an Egyptian structure, and I've never thought it was an Egyptian structure. It's probably the oldest monument on the planet. And when you couple the just the apparent physics and engineering of the structure, and then go back and look at those texts, put the two together, and what you have is the hypothesis that this was actually a component of a very sophisticated weapon system. Now, the interesting thing is if you look at the Great Pyramid itself, it's also quite evident that there are things missing from the inside of it. And this Dunn brings out brilliantly in his book. When you think of the Grand Gallery inside the structure, it's got those 27 slots on each side going up the Grand Gallery, which he thinks was filled with resonators because the Grand Gallery does act like an acoustical amplification chamber. It's designed to be that.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's designed to vibrate, as is the whole structure itself. The Great Pyramid, unlike any other pyramid in the world, sits on four sockets, actually five, but one on each corner of the structure, like a ball and socket joint in bones. Okay. So in other words, the structure was built not only to withstand earthquakes, it was built to vibrate constantly with the earth, all right? And that alone places all those quartz crystals in the structure under stress. And when quartz is under stress, it gives out little packets of sound called phonons. So the whole structure is constantly quivering, constantly.
Hmm.
Well, Dunn thinks that the Grand Gallery was filled with resonators called Helmholtz resonators. And Dunn, when he wrote his book, I've spoken with Chris Dunn at some conferences, and I've asked him very directly, when you wrote the book, did you know anything about Zechariah Sitchin? He said, no. And I said, did you know that Zechariah Sitchin, on the basis of an examination of texts, came to the same conclusion that you did on the basis of the examination of the structure from an engineer's point of view, and came to the conclusion that there were things missing inside the Grand Gallery.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which, in Sitchin's opinion, were crystals. So, you know, everything points to this structure being an extraordinarily sophisticated physics device of some sort. And you don't engineer that amount of things into a structure to be resonant with local celestial space and all the systems in it unless you are attempting to manipulate those things. So everything, in my opinion, is pointing to this thing being some sort of weapon, including the textual references.
An incredibly advanced weapon.
Horribly advanced, yes.
Yeah, horribly advanced. That's a good way to put it. Now, it's interesting you mentioned Sitchin there, because Sitchin is actually not well known for his studies on the Great Pyramid. His name is so closely tied to his Sumerian Anunnaki research.
Right.
But he had a powerful book that examines
right.
Egypt in great detail, and it had a major effect on you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The book is called The Wars of Gods and Men. And to me, Daniel, the most interesting thing about Sitchin and that book is he very clearly thought that it was some sort of weapon.
Uh-huh.
But it never dawns on him. You know, it's kind of made in passing as he's trying to explicate the text. And it never dawns on him. If that's true, it's a hugely significant thing. And it never dawns on him to examine it further. And what's very interesting to me, Daniel, is when you study the Great Pyramid, one of the things you find out is the people studying the Great Pyramid are an unusual lot.
Yeah.
Physicists like Lambert Dolphin, who was involved, you know, in the Stanford SRI remote viewing project. Physicists and engineers like Joe Parr, Farouk Elbaz, who was also NASA's site selection guy for the moon landings. You had the famous cosmological study of, you know, physicists trying to measure cosmic rays in the two big pyramids there at Giza. So in other words, there has been an intense interest in people from the physics community, particularly from this country and particularly from physicists with connections to the defense industry. And the question is, why? And then, lo and behold, to cap all of this off, to make just the final little bit of icing on the cake for the argument here, the Soviet Union during the 1960s and 1970s, most people don't know this, the Soviet Union had a secret pyramid project. They were building these fiberglass pyramids of all sizes and shapes all over the Soviet Union, and doing experiments on pyramid power. let's just be blunt.
Well, we did those here eventually, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Why were the Soviets doing this? And why did it only come out after the collapse of the Soviet Union when, you know, people were finally able to travel around? There's all these big pyramids outside of Moscow. You know, what were they doing? Well, one of the things they noticed was the pyramids themselves were apparently giving off these little streams of energy from their apex that could, under certain circumstances, interfere with electrical equipment.
That's fascinating.
So, you know, stuff like this constantly. And during World War II, you dig even deeper, you find out that the British were warning their pilots, don't fly your planes over the pyramid.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's true. That's very true.
Well, what is this about the pyramid shape itself, that when they've used it, you could do things like keep fruit fresh and sharpen mm-hmm. razor blades and stuff. What is it about this shape? And you do find the shape, even though the Great Pyramid is the ultimate expression, mm-hmm. the other pyramids that you see everywhere from China to South America, they're everywhere. Yeah. But the ancients knew about that shape. We don't know what the deal is, apparently.
Well, there is an interesting physicist in the Ukraine, in Kiev, by the name of Volodymyr Krasnoholovits, that was actually involved in the Soviet pyramid project. And then after the collapse of the Soviet Union, he began to publish some of his data and work. And he published a number of very arcane mathematical papers with a Canadian topologist by the name of Michel Bounias. I actually quote some of these papers in one of the pyramid books. And what Krasnoholovits theorized was that the shape itself, the geometry of it, is actually designed to manipulate, he doesn't say this himself, so I want to be very clear here, but in my reading, what he's saying is that the pyramid shape itself is designed to manipulate fields of quantum information at the very smallest level. And to my way of thinking, what he's talking about is that they're manipulating the Dirac Sea. The Dirac Sea is the sea of virtual energy, the zero point energy, in other words, that gives rise to particles. All right. In certain configurations, the Soviets discovered that narrow pyramids like obelisks function more like antennas. They project energy. Pyramids that are flatter, like the Dasher pyramids, act as collectors. The Great Pyramid is exactly in the middle and can be a collector or an antenna all at once because of its unique properties. And they speculate, Krasnoholov speculates, that it's the geometry itself and its local manipulation of the field of information at the deepest level, at, so to speak, the alchemical level of the Philosopher's Stone, that's producing these effects in fruits and vegetables, keeping razors sharp, and so on and so forth. The Soviets did a number of experiments with water that was placed inside of pyramids that had enormously curative properties they discovered. So they were even using these things to regenerate oil fields,
wow. You know,
putting pyramids over oil wells. They did all sorts of bizarre stuff. That tells me that the Soviets, given the fact that the Russians are such good nonlinear scientists and mathematicians, that they knew something to even design an experiment like that. And now it's kind of beginning to catch on in the West. And Krasnoholovets was the one that kind of brought all this into the attention of the West with his papers. So, yeah, it's manipulating quantum reality. And again, we're right back at CERN when we say this,
right.
because it's manipulating reality at a very fundamental level.
Well, it's pretty interesting, and you mentioned alchemy in there also, because the pyramid was built so far back in antiquity, probably before 10,000 BC, really.
Right.
Even the traditional date models are closer to 5,000 years ago. And, you know, then we have CERN now, which is very 21st century and beyond. Mm-hmm. Now, in esoteric traditions, like anthroposophy, like theosophy, or the Casey material, they put a real emphasis on the idea that back in this antediluvian period, the etheric and the physical conditions were totally different.
Yes.
That matter itself was different. That now we have much more dense matter, and we were operating more from the cosmic into the physical back then.
Yes.
So something like the Great Pyramid would resonate and work incredibly well at the time and have a huge impact on this ethereal world. But that in our era, this kind of thing, you know, the thing that you would need now would be more of a CERN type of project manipulating this dense matter.
Yes.
So how do you feel about that? You know, having looked at all this, do you think that matter is more dense now? I know it's a kind of a more of a metaphysical, alchemical question than a scientific one.
Oh, it's a good one. It's a very good one.
Good.
Most modern physics, I'll put it to you this way. Most modern physics proceeds along the assumption that the constants of physics are more or less constant. That's why they're called that. But every now and then in the physics literature, you've had cosmological physicists, quantum mechanics people playing around with theories where the constants of physics are variable over time. And in one or two instances, even more interestingly, variable as wave functions, very long cycle wave functions. All right. So that brings us back to Babylon's banksters, for those that are paying attention. But one of these guys, here is an interesting thing for you. Actually, let me talk about two of these guys that thought this. One of them was a fellow by the name of Pascual Jordan. All right. Jordan was a major influence in quantum mechanics, in the development of the standard model that physicists use now. He was Nobel Prize material, absolutely. And in fact, the only reason he was denied his Nobel Prize was because he was an ardent Nazi.
Oh, well, that's intriguing.
Yeah. This guy is quite famous, and he played around with these types of theories of variable constants. He came up with what's called the transer-scalar theory of cosmology, where you had variable constants. And in the theory, the Earth was actually growing more dense and accumulating matter over time.
That's something.
Okay? And that, in some of their thinking, was what is ultimately driving the continents apart. As the Earth accumulates mass, it begins to stretch.
Oh, that's okay. Really fascinating.
Yeah. And there's a certain amount of data that suggests this, incidentally. The other guy, which to me is even more interesting, most people have never even heard of this guy, except in Germany, where he's very popular, was one of Gerlach's students by the name of Ott Christian Hilgenberg. All right. Hilgenberg is another one of these just bizarre geniuses that, you know, comes up with all of these ideas.
Right, yeah.
One of the ideas he came up with was precisely this idea, and I think this is where Jordan ultimately got it, because Hilgenberg published this in the late 1930s, this idea of changing constants of physics over time and long cycles of change and undulation over time. published this in a paper in Germany, I think in 1938. And he did other fun stuff too, like inventing what he called a quantum ring hexagonal construction principle for the periodic table of the elements. And that is that's even more of a tongue twister in German, let me tell you. But, in this paper that he published, ostensibly in the 1930s, although I've only been able to find a 1950s copy of it, ostensibly he predicted that the transuranic elements, in other words, elements like 115, 116, 117, way out there in the periodic table, that these elements would be extremely heavy and very stable. Which, if you were a physicist back then and looking at things like Neptunium and Lawrencium and Nobelium and all of this stuff, where is he getting this idea that they're going to be stable? Because we're looking at half-lives in the billions of seconds, that these elements are around. Well, go beyond that, and he's predicting this island of stability in the transuranic elements way before they're actually synthesized. And lo and behold, when they are finally synthesized, guess what? He was right. That these are stable elements. In other words, he basically reconstructed the entire principle of the whole periodic table of the elements, top to bottom, on the basis of all of these crazy theories and changing constants. So in other words, you've got this physics literature that does indicate that there could be a way of explaining this esoteric idea of less dense, more ethereal matter way back when, and more dense material matter now. And in fact, if you stop and think about it, Daniel, this is what the Big Bang Theory is telling you, with strangeless quark gluon plasmas, and then basically as things cool off, die down, and clump together, you get the more dense matter that we know now. So yeah, it's definitely there in the physics literature.
Wow, you can actually scientifically substantiate
yes
the idea. And it's interesting, too, because the idea in the esoteric work is because things were more ethereal, they were more in touch with, their more spiritual side, their psychic side, their vision was totally mm-hmm. different.
Yes.
They could envision, a kind of clairvoyant astral version of a thing. They didn't have to look
yes.
at it just physically.
Yes.
Which would really, when you get to our vision of things now in the 21st century versus what they were doing, it really cuts our vision off because mm-hmm. we're blinded by a number of these things.
Well, I think what is happening, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think what's happening is you're seeing the death of the Victorian 19th century, 20th century materialism. Mm-hmm. that has ruled our cosmology and thinking for the last 150 or so years, because you are definitely seeing a change now in physics towards the role of consciousness. I have a fascinating webinar in my members area on the website concerning the work of Dr. William Tiller, University of California professor of materials science, where he does nothing but experiment with conscious intention and how it can affect the actual material world.
Interesting.
And it's fascinating stuff. You're seeing this change happen now. You've got Rupert Sheldrake in biology with his morphogenetic fields.
Right.
You're seeing the turn back to the ethereal or the incorporeal or the spiritual or whatever you wish to call that element of non-material science. And it's very interesting because when you look at the ancient world, and I think Schwaller-Golubich brought this out perhaps the best of anybody studying all of that stuff, he pointed out that for the ancients, there wasn't this neat division of science and philosophy and religion and spirituality. It was all just kind of one thing.
Yes.
To these people. Well, that's a highly, if you look at it with modern physics eyes, that's a highly unified field.
Right.
And therefore, any technology that you produce utilizing that type of thinking is going to be a technology that will have a profound influence in all of those areas. And I think, again, when you look at the Great Pyramid, this is what you're seeing. You're seeing a product of that kind of grand vision, where all of these things are deeply interconnected.
It is so interesting. And I get the feeling that there's a collective understanding out there on a subconscious level, but that almost every force in modern life is in exact opposition to an individual getting into contact with that consciousness. So if the Great Pyramid contains all of that understanding, then we may be looking at its evil twin in the CERN Hadron Collider, a new Death Star for a dense modern age of materialism. So let's go deep into part two here on CERN and what they really are up to, with some surprises in store. Now, Dark Journalist subscribers will get that special part two episode next week in their inbox. So now's the time to subscribe so you don't miss the discount and don't miss out on the great episodes we have coming up for you. Now, Joseph, just amazing analysis, and thanks so much for being on the show today. Of course, all of your information is at GizaDeathStar.com, just a great website, and I can't wait to do part two with you.
Well, thank you for having me back on. Appreciate it.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with Dr. Joseph Farrell on CERN Death Star, Final Apotheosis. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Subscribe to our newsletter at darkjournalist.com to stay updated on the latest shows.